Well, thanks for that introduction. I'm glad to be here. You all look wonderful this morning. We're going to be spending a little bit of time looking at a certain individual in the Bible. We're going to look at Jacob. We're going to look a little bit about Jacob's life. I want to start by going to when he's born. If you'll turn to Genesis 25, we'll look here at the birth of Jacob. We're going to look at several events in Jacob's life to get kind of an idea about who he is. Here in Genesis 25, I'm also probably going to be summarizing a little bit of these accounts because we're going to go from Genesis 25, we're going to end up in Genesis 32. So we're not going to read all these chapters. But in Genesis 25, beginning in verse 19, it reads, "This is the account of the family of Isaac, the son of Abraham. When Isaac was 40 years old, he married Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Padan Aram, and the sister of Laban, the Aramean. Isaac pleaded with the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was unable to have children. The Lord answered Isaac's prayer, and Rebekah became pregnant with twins. But the two children struggled with each other in her womb. So she went to ask the Lord about it. 'Why is this happening to me?' she asked. And the Lord told her, 'The sons in your womb will become two nations. From the very beginning, the two nations will be rivals. One nation will be stronger than the other, and your older son will serve your younger son.' And when the time came to give birth, Rebekah discovered that she indeed had twins. The first one was very red at birth and covered with thick hair like a fur coat. So they named him Esau. Then the other twin was born with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So they named him Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when the twins were born." Already here in the beginning of Jacob's life, Scripture notes that he was grasping or holding on to Esau's heel. And this is actually a Hebraism, which means that he's kind of going to be a trickster. To hold on to somebody's heel is to be a trickster. We're going to fast forward a little bit to where the boys grow up and Jacob ends up stealing Esau's birthright. This is in Genesis 25:27, starting the next verse. And basically, when Esau comes back in from hunting on this one occasion and Jacob had made some food, Esau was famished, hungry. He's just starving. He wants some food. And he didn't really think much of his position as the eldest son. And Jacob saw this as an opportunity to exploit Esau's hunger. So he ends up basically bargaining to give Esau some food in exchange for his birthright. And Esau really doesn't care. He's like, "Fine, you know, you can take my birthright. Just give me some food before I die, because what good is it if I die and can't even have my birthright?" So Jacob then gives Esau some lentil stew. But this account here shows Jacob's conniving mannerism and how he really capitalized on a lot of opportunities, specifically right here, to try and get more out of life. As the younger son, he wanted to get that double portion, which was the birthright of the eldest. Next account I want to touch on is where Jacob deceives Isaac in order to get the eldest son's blessing. So when Isaac was old, this is in Genesis 27, starting in verse 1. When Isaac was old, he called Esau, his firstborn, in and told him that he wanted him to make some food for him, to go out and hunt, catch some game, make some food so he could have a meal, and then give him his blessing. Well, Rebekah overheard this and plotted a way to get Jacob to have the blessing instead. The blessing of the clan patriarch, which was Isaac, upon the eldest son, was actually a symbolic formality that would name the son as the patriarch's successor. The blessing would confer upon the son the right and authority to rule the clan following the patriarch's death. So while tricking Isaac to give Jacob the blessing, it was originally Rebekah's idea. Jacob was not opposed to it. He just wanted a good plan so that he wouldn't get caught in the act and be cursed because of his deception. The one thing that he objected to was that if Isaac touches him, he's going to realize he's not a hairy man. And therefore, he's going to realize that he's being deceived. So that was his one concern, was just trying to have a foolproof plan to get what he wanted out of this scheme. Fast forward a little bit further. after Jacob steals Esau's blessing from Isaac, Esau is just enraged and wants to kill Jacob. And so Rebekah comes up with this plan to want to marry off Jacob and find a wife for him. So she decides to send him to her relatives, her kindred, up north in Paddan Aram. Rebekah comes up with this idea to send Jacob back up north to Paddan Aram, where his family was, to find a wife in order to escape Esau's anger so that both of her kids didn't end up dying in one day. So Jacob gets sent up to Laban, and when he gets there, he ends up seeing this girl named Rachel. He thinks she's beautiful. He wants to marry her, and so he talks to her father Laban, and Laban's like, well, you worked for me for 7 years. And he's like, cool, okay, I'll do that. Well, during this time, a lot transpired. Jacob got deceived a little bit, kind of a little bit of irony there, and he ended up wedding Leah first, and then later getting Rachel, and then having to work 7 more years. So he worked 14 years total for this guy to get his 2 daughters.
That guy was slippery.
He met his match.
He met his match. Yeah. But up there, there came a time when Jacob, Laban asked him what he should pay Jacob for all of his services after this. And Jacob was just like, well, let me have all the spotted and striped animals in your flock as my wage. So it's kind of meeting his match. Laban decides to remove all the striped and spotted animals from his flock and give them to his other sons so that Jacob wouldn't have any. You know, like if you basically remove all the genetic traits from the flock, you're not going to have those genetic traits anymore. Funny thing was that Laban's flocks ended up starting to produce striped and spotted animals. And Jacob also kind of connived and schemed as well for a way to have Laban's flocks mate, the strong animals mate with the spotted and striped females and produce strong offspring that had spots and stripes, which would end up being his. And he did that through like separating the strong animals from the weak and then setting this peeled wood in the watering troughs, which supposedly, I don't know how it did it, but it made the animals produce spotted and striped traits. Kind of a weird, it's a weird aspect of the story. But then also he had Laban's flocks face the striped and dark sheep and breed with them intentionally because they bred during watering times. So Jacob basically becomes much more wealthy than Laban, and his flocks are stronger and more numerous. And so then there's some jealousy that comes up with Laban, and then Jacob ends up taking off and leaving and heading back toward the land of Canaan. We pick up the record in Genesis 32. So now we're trying to catch an idea of all the stuff that Jacob's been involved in and how he has swindled Esau of his birthright, Esau of his blessing. He has basically taken over and planned this scheme to favor his flocks over Laban's flocks so that he would become more wealthy and prosperous on behalf of Laban. And so there's all this scheming and conniving going on, all this planning and deception. And here in Genesis 32, he's heading back south toward where Esau lives, and he has one of his servants send word to Esau that he's coming. We're going to read here, starting in 32:3. Then Jacob sent messengers ahead to his brother Esau, who was living in the region of Seir in the land of Edom. He told them, "Give this message to my master Esau. Humble greetings from your servant Jacob. Until now I have been living with uncle Laban, and now I own cattle, donkeys, flocks of sheep and goats, and many servants, both men and women. I have sent these messengers to inform my lord of my coming, hoping that you will be friendly to me." Verse 6. After delivering the message, the messengers returned to Jacob and reported, "We met your brother Esau, and he is already on his way to meet you with an army of 400 men. Jacob was terrified at the news. He divided his household along with the flocks and herds and camels into 2 groups. He thought, if Esau meets one group and attacks it, perhaps the other group can escape. Then Jacob prayed, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, you told me, return to your own land and to your relatives, and you promised me, I will treat you kindly. I am not worthy of all the unfailing love and faithfulness you have shown to me, your servant. When I left home and crossed the Jordan River, I owned nothing except a walking stick. Now my household fills 2 large camps. O Lord, please rescue me from the hand of my brother Esau. I am afraid that he is coming to attack me along with my wives and children. But you promised me, I will surely treat you kindly, and I will multiply your descendants until they become as numerous as the sands along the seashore, too many to count. Verse 13, Jacob stayed where he was for the night. Then he selected these gifts from his possessions to present to his brother Esau, 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, 30 female camels with their young, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, and 10 male donkeys. He divided these animals into herds and assigned each to different servants. Then he told his servants, go ahead of me with the animals, but keep some distance between the herds. He gave these instructions to the men leading the first group. When my brother Esau meets you, he will ask, whose servants are you? Where are you going? Who owns these animals? You must reply, they belong to your servant Jacob, but they are a gift for his master Esau. Look, he is coming right behind us. Jacob gave the same instructions to the second and third herdsmen, to all who followed behind the herds. You must say the same thing to Esau when you meet him, and be sure to say, look, your servant Jacob is right behind us. Jacob thought, I will try to appease him by sending gifts ahead of me. When I see him in person, perhaps he will be friendly to me. So the gifts were sent on ahead while Jacob himself spent that night in the camp. So Jacob was basically trying to devise a plan here to win over Esau's favor by sending ahead multiple gifts. Even though God had given Jacob the promise that he would cause Jacob's offspring to multiply and to inherit the land, and even Jacob prayed to God the same thing and reiterated the promise, he still began trying to figure out how to win over Esau's favor because he was afraid of him. Jacob still took everything into his own hands and was bent on trying to get what he wanted instead of trusting in God's provision and God's promise. Jacob's plan was to send these elaborate gifts in order to pacify Esau and any potential ill will that still remained from the time when he stole the elder son blessing from him when Jacob deceived Isaac. And even beyond that, as we read here, let's read verse 22 and 23. During the night, Jacob got up and took his 2 wives, his 2 servants, and his 11 sons and crossed the Jabbok River with them. After taking them to the other side, he sent over all his possessions. Jacob arises in the night and takes his entire family across the Jabbok River and all his possessions to the side where Esau is coming from. Jacob then returns to the far side of the river. It says here in verse 24, this left Jacob all alone in the camp. Jacob had struggled his entire life with people, and he had done everything he could to get what he wanted. Here he's desperately trying to earn Esau's favor so that Esau won't kill him. And so it seems that here at the river Jabbok, that Jacob has stretched himself as far as he can go by sending all of his family, all of his flocks, all of his servants, all of his possessions over toward Esau, and then coming back across the river and staying by himself in the camp. It seems that Jacob has come to the end of himself here. And here we enter the record that I want to look at. Here in Genesis 32, verse 24, this is a brief account of Jacob wrestling near the river Jabbok. And this record is tantalizingly obscure in vagueness and simplicity because there's very few details that are mentioned, but it's a very important turning point in Jacob's life. Here in verse 24, we read, this left Jacob all alone in the camp. And a man came and wrestled with him until the dawn began to break. Well, the prophet Hosea here identifies this man as an angel of the Lord. In Hosea 12, 3 through 5, it says, "In the womb, he, Jacob, grasped his brother's heel, and as an adult, he wrestled with God. Jacob struggled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He found him at Bethel and there spoke with him. Yahweh is the God of hosts. Yahweh is his name." It's kind of ironic, though, that Jacob finds himself here alone at the river Jabbok, and he wrestles with an angel, because then the Hebrew name Jabbok actually means an emptying or wrestling. It actually means both. Jacob experiences these two things at the river Jabbok. And it's here in the mud of the Jabbok River that Jacob was empty, alone. He was at his wit's end, and he found himself fighting yet again. It seems that Jacob's true colors were shining through as he continued to do what he does best, to fight, to scrap, and to figure out how to win. Verse 25, "When the man saw that he would not win the match, he touched Jacob's right hip and wrenched it out of its socket. Jacob and the angel wrestled through the night, but the text says that the angel did not prevail against Jacob." The point here is not whether the angel was strong enough or not to defeat Jacob. Verse 25 here is highlighting how Jacob exerted everything he had to try and win. He would not back down. He would not let go, and he would not give up. He fought the angel through the night. Jacob was being as tenacious with the angel as a bulldog with a pork chop. He determined that he wasn't going to lose. But then the angel touched Jacob's hip, and everything changed. Jacob now became the underdog, injured and disadvantaged. You know, we often let go of someone if they just simply pinch us. But the angel touches Jacob's hip and sends his joint out of socket. There's all kinds of intense pain and inflammation that happens when a joint is out of socket. And even though Jacob was severely wounded by the angel, he kept on fighting. He kept struggling. He kept trying to win. He continued to grapple with the angel even with a dislocated hip. It's like he was white-knuckling it with even the slightest glance at his face would reveal his desperate and anguished countenance, like a man hanging from a cliff. Everything was riding on not letting go, on not giving up. In verse 26, as we continue, "Then he," referring to the angel, "said, 'Let me go, for the day is breaking.' But Jacob said, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.' So he said to him, 'What is your name?' And he said, 'Jacob.' Then the man said, 'You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven or fought with God and with humans and have prevailed or overcome.'" As the dawn is approaching here and the sun was peering over the horizon, the angel directs Jacob to release him. But while probably hobbling to maintain his balance and to hide the expression of excruciating pain upon his face, Jacob was not done fighting the angel. He was not throwing in the towel yet. Even in his disadvantaged and seemingly hopeless position, Jacob demands a blessing from the angel. The angel says, "Let me go." Jacob says, "I will not let you go unless you bless me, unless I get what I want." This rebellious spirit of Jacob denying the request of the angel really shows Jacob's attitude of trying to always be self-serving. Despite the circumstances, Jacob is relentless in striving to get what he wants. He wants to receive that blessing. However, the angel does not merely oblige Jacob and offer him a blessing when Jacob refuses to let him go. Instead, the angel prompts Jacob to reveal his name. The angel is not asking Jacob to identify himself because the angel just doesn't know who Jacob is, or that he's wrestling with the son of Isaac. The angel's question is merely a rhetorical device in the story to help Jacob recognize who he is. So what's in a name? Well, we read back in Genesis 25, that the name Jacob, the Hebrew word Jacob, means something like deceiver. And grabbing at the heel is a Hebraic expression that he's going to be a trickster. This is the point kind of Esau's remark in Genesis 27:36, where Esau, after Jacob had taken his elder son blessing, Esau says, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob? For he has cheated me twice now. He took my birthright, and look, he has now taken my blessing." Jacob had always outsmarted, outmaneuvered, and outdistanced his opponents throughout his life. But here at the river Jabbok, Jacob comes face to face with God's angel, and the angel forces him to remember who he really is. He is Jacob, the deceiver, the one who works his own methods and schemes for his own gain and interests. But after Jacob acknowledges his own name and all the traits and identity from his past that go with it, the angel suddenly changes Jacob's name. The changing of a name in the Bible usually indicates something significant. Names are often given to designate special places and events, specific encounters or circumstances, and particularly divine callings. In light of Jacob's confession of who he is, the angel declares that Jacob will now be called Israel, which means God fights. Jacob would be the one who would have God on his side and who need not exert his own efforts to receive what God has prepared for him. It is interesting to note here, though, that there is a play on words. The angel explains that Jacob's name shall be called Israel because Jacob has striven or fought with God and with humans and have prevailed. But the real meaning of the Hebrew word for Israel is God fights. The irony in this wordplay is that it was Jacob who was fighting with God, but his name would be God fights. The old name Jacob recalled who he was in his past in his underhand dealings with men, but his new name, Israel, would signify this new incident where he fought with God, so to say, that God, through his angel, though, was trying to show Jacob something about himself, something about who he used to be, but now who he was going to become. Jacob's new name, Israel, signified that even though Jacob had fought with humans and with God, God would be the one fighting for him. However, the name Israel also holds a double entendre, for Jacob's descendants would become a rebellious people who would also continually fight with God. Therefore, interestingly, Jacob's name change is actually a prophetic word concerning the future nation of Israel who would come from Jacob. This prophetic word was for how God would fight for them and fulfill his purposes through them, and yet they would also be stubborn and rebellious just like their ancestor Jacob. Let's pick this back up here in verse 29. So then Jacob asked him, the angel, "Please tell me your name." But he, the angel, said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" Still not satisfied at this point in the fight, not satisfied to concede, Jacob now reciprocates and asks the angel to identify himself. But the angel does not indulge him. The angel quickly turns the question around and fires it back at him. "Why is it that you ask my name?" The whole encounter has nothing to do with the identity of the angel. The purpose for the angel wrestling with Jacob was to show Jacob something about who he was. Sometimes it requires our own self-recognition of who we are before we're willing to change. Amen. Continuing on here, it says, "And there he, the angel, blessed him, Jacob. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, 'For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved.'" Instead of identifying himself, the angel proceeds to extend a blessing to Jacob, and then the angel departs just as mysteriously as he appeared. And so Jacob names the place where he wrestled with the angel in the mud of the Jabbok, Peniel, which means the face of God. This intriguing episode of Jacob wrestling at Jabbok concludes in verse 31 here by saying, "The sun arose upon him, Jacob, as he passed Peniel," which is just an alternate spelling of the name Peniel, "limping because of his hip." Verse 32, "Therefore to this day the Israelites do not eat the thigh muscle that is on the hip socket, because he, the angel, struck Jacob on the hip socket at the thigh muscle." We might look at the account of Jacob wrestling with the angel at Jabbok as a positive encounter, potentially, showing Jacob's persistence and determination to never give up and to keep going no matter what, even when the going gets tough. But that's the opposite of what this incident is representing and what we can learn from it. What this encounter of Jacob exposes is that in the mud of the Jabbok, Jacob was unwilling to yield to the angel because he had always relied on his own abilities and the strength of his own shoulders, as he did time and time again. God had already given Jacob the promise that he would increase his descendants like the sand of the sea and like the dust of the earth, and give them the land of Canaan as an inheritance to his descendants. Even when Jacob was at Bethel, after leaving, when Rebekah sent him away to Laban, he was traveling toward Paddan Aram before he met Rachel. God told Jacob in Genesis 28:15, "Look, I am with you. I will watch over you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." But Jacob was in the habit of excluding God from his plans and devising his own methods for how to succeed. Even after praying and acknowledging this promise, as we read when he was getting ready to meet Esau and the 400 men that were coming at him, Jacob began starting to try to figure it out on his own with devising how to send those gifts ahead of him. How many times have we tried to figure things out because we didn't trust God was going to come through? We tried to do things our way. We seem to be pretty good about conjuring up and following our own ideas and planning God right out of the picture. Sometimes when we're in the thick of it, we can only see what's coming at us, like Jacob being terrified of Esau. We tend to only see the obstacle that we must overcome. We only see us, the rock, and the hard place. The author of Hebrews recalls the words of Moses that he spoke to Joshua by stating that God will never fail us or abandon us, from Deuteronomy 31. I'd like to read that really quick. You don't have to turn there. But in Deuteronomy 31, in verse 4 through 6, Moses is telling Joshua here when they're getting ready to enter the promised land. Verse 4, "The Lord will destroy the nations living in the land, just as he destroyed Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites. The Lord will hand over to you the people who live there. So you must deal with them as I have commanded you. So be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid and do not panic before them. For the Lord your God will personally go ahead of you. He will neither fail you nor abandon you." Whatever plan God might have, it is better than any plan that we could come up with. But if we panic and if we become terrified about the circumstances we face, we are likely to fall back into our own self-reliance and our old ways of getting things done on our own and in our own manner. If we lose sight of God in the midst of what we're dealing with, it will become difficult to recognize if we slide back down into the mud of the Jabbok. It's only when we surrender our all to God that we can see past ourselves and our desire to take charge, to do whatever we think should be done. However, God is inviting us into companionship and cooperation with Him, not a contest. Just as God promised to Jacob, and as Moses reminded Joshua, God will be with us wherever we will go. And if there are places that we want to go and things that we want to do, and if God's not willing to take us there, then we shouldn't want to go. Let's not rely on our own wisdom, our own cleverness, experience, liabilities, or ambition. As Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 1:25, "The foolish plan of God is wiser than the wisest plan of humans, and the weakness of God is stronger than the greatest of human strength." Let's surrender all of who we are to all of who He is. Let's go places with God and not on our own.